I am the Martian ambassador. We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace.
You know, that's just like your opinion, man.
It's time for Shouts from the Back Row, the official podcast of the-back-row.com. My name is Gil, and I'm your host. And with me, as always, are my co-hosts, Robin.
Do you smell what Robin is cooking?
And TK.
Aim for the bushes.
The Fate of the Furious is tearing up the big screen right now, and even though it has an all-star cast, I think we can all agree that one name stands out above the rest. He's one of the biggest stars working today, quite literally, in fact. He's one of the most charming, likable actors out there, Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And not only is he an incredibly likable actor, but he's also one of the hardest working actors in operation today, with no fewer than 12 projects currently in development. But for all that he's charismatic and prolific, has The Rock made many good movies? Well, that's among the topics we'll be discussing on this episode of Shouts from the Back Row, as we look at the career of the most electrifying man in sports entertainment, the owner of the People's Eyebrow, here to layeth the smacketh down. We'll be listing our favorite and least favorite performances from Dwayne Johnson, giving our thoughts on his meteoric rise to fame, and pondering whether he should have taken his own advice when he said, "Know your role and shut your mouth." So the question is, gentlemen, can you smell what The Rock is cooking? It's the films of Dwayne The Rock Johnson right after this. The Back Row is dedicated to delivering free entertainment to everyone in the forms of media culture blogging, movie reviews, short films, podcasts, and more. That's awesome, I hear you say, and you're right, it is pretty awesome, so why don't you subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and leave us a review. Just search the iTunes store for Shouts from the Back Row to subscribe to our feed, and if you're feeling generous, visit the-back-row.com and click the donate button to send us a few bucks. Your support means the world to us. We like to open the show with a discussion of what we've been up to. This is a place for us to talk about movies we've been watching, TV shows we've been following, games we've been playing, just about everything else we've been doing. So, TK, what have you been up to?
I can't say I've been up to a whole lot. I did see my second most anticipated film of the year, Free Fire, the other day. And it was sadly disappointing. Despite the stellar cast, the best parts of this film are in the trailer. And while it was fun to watch, it was a low-budget Guy Ritchie, and we already have a Guy Ritchie, and it doesn't really flow as well. I said the cast costuming was all fantastic, but it just, I don't know. There wasn't as much pizzazz as I was expecting from the trailers. So it kind of fell flat for me, which is too bad. Yeah.
Like, what didn't work? Was the action? Did the action not work? Because I understand that this movie is like one long gunfight, right?
Yeah, that's right. But it's fairly realistically done, but I just didn't buy it. I wasn't very invested, and like the gunfire stuff wasn't faster, like, or intense enough to really get me.
And the humor is not up to snuff either?
No, not up to snuff either. Like I said, a great cast, but just sort of like there was a couple, like I laughed throughout the film, but not like it was more like, oh, that's, you know, that shot's clever, or like things like that. But it wasn't, I don't know, it just didn't do it for me. It wasn't exactly what I was expecting. I think I was expecting a Guy Ritchie-like movie, and got something a lot more slower pace and a lot less showy. And I think that's what the main difference was between everything. And the one thing I did notice, that there wasn't very much of a soundtrack. Like, background music was like non-existent. I think that put me off a little bit too. So, like, if the trailer interests you, just keep in mind that that's the showiest parts of the film, and the rest of it's a lot more drawn out.
That's really interesting, because, you know, of course, this is the new film from director Ben Wheatley, and previously on the podcast, I've championed Wheatley's work, in particular the film Kill List, but I don't know. It's really interesting. I'm trying to remember. TK, did you see High Rise? I think you did, right?
Yes, I did. And like I said, I enjoyed it, but I wanted to do a second watch because I think there was some editing stuff in it, I think, that would have worked better, but I haven't had a chance to rewatch it yet. But I did enjoy it the first time I saw it.
Do you feel it's just all of this is very interesting to me because I haven't seen High Rise. I haven't seen Free Fire, and they are clearly the most visually dynamic or visually rich Ben Wheatley films in all his filmography. I saw his first two films, which are very, like, realistic in terms of the costumes and just the locations and the lighting even. They're all just, like, very grounded in reality, whereas High Rise, it seems, has this wild style applied to it, and Free Fire is, like, this 1970s kind of look. So, I don't know, it's really interesting to hear that Wheatley's more visually impressive films are also being received more poorly than his less visually arresting ones. I don't know, I find that really interesting.
And I also saw Free Rise, and I kind of have, or sorry, Free Fire, and I also have kind of the same thoughts that TK has. It was a decent enough time, but I did feel kind of underwhelmed and lukewarm by it. Probably because we recently did our own podcast on movies set in one location. So I'm thinking, okay, if they're doing a movie that's literally like a shootout that's nearly an hour long, they're kind of going to burst out some clever stuff. And, well, it was entertaining enough. They didn't really, like, blow my mind with it or anything. The one thing I did like is that they set it during the 1970s. So it was kind of fun to see it take place in this era, like pre-cell phone, without any real technology. So it would be a believable scenario that these people could be trapped in the warehouse in a shootout with no way to get out. And I kind of like the way it didn't try to do like any like Hong Kong, like defying physics type of thing. Like the shootout was treated in kind of a realistic fashion, like how bullets would really fire if you were in that situation. So it didn't turn into like a flashy action movie. But at the same time, it did get kind of repetitive and monotonous because it was a lot of scenes of people hiding behind things and then shouting obscenities at each other and then shooting each other and wounding each other. But it didn't really, it kind of felt like it ran out of steam, which is kind of a shame because it did have an excellent cast. And even though TK did mention that it had very little of a soundtrack, I did kind of enjoy the frequent pop-ups of John Denver on the soundtrack randomly. I thought that was kind of a funny touch. But even though it was only like 90 minutes long, it did kind of run thin at the end, probably because I really wasn't invested in any of these characters. There was really no reason to care for them that much at all. So it was just kind of sitting around and watching them shoot at each other, but you don't really care who survives or anything. So yeah, kind of a thumbs in the middle for me. Not a terrible movie, but I was kind of underwhelmed by it. And this is actually my very first Ben Wheatley film. I have yet to see any of his other ones, but I wasn't overly impressed with him here.
Fascinating. I wonder if Wheatley is delivering diminishing returns. And at some point, I'm going to get you guys to watch Kill List, because I think you will both really enjoy it, and it sounds just so different than movies like Free Fire or High Rise. Clearly a topic we need to revisit. What else have you been up to, TK?
Honestly, that's about it, to be honest. I've caught up with a bit of Better Call Saul, but I want to talk about it when I'm a few more episodes in. And that's about it. I also haven't watched any of Fargo, so I know you're going to talk about Gil. Please don't spoil anything.
Okay, no spoilers.
Thank you. And that's literally all I've had a chance to be up to, guys. What have you been doing?
Robin, what have you been up to?
Well, other than Free Fire, I saw The Fate and the Furious, but I'm going to talk about that one a bit later when we talk more about The Rock. But one thing I do want to talk about now is Mystery Science Theater 3000, The Return. In case you haven't heard, I talked a few weeks ago that in anticipation for this, they uploaded a bunch of classic episodes of Mystery Science Theater into Netflix, so I was catching up on those. And now they have a new version up with new performers and new voice actors. And I was briefly talking about this with McGill, that the episodes we've seen so far are just as good as the B-plus episodes of the original Mystery Science Theater. I wouldn't say I've seen anything so far that has made me, like, blown me away or made me just roll in hysterics. I don't think there's anything yet that I've seen that it matches the quality of the top Mystery Science Theater's episodes, but it's still really, really good, really fun watch. Since I've been busy the last few weeks watching stuff like the Leafs in the playoffs in the NHL, I haven't been able to see as many episodes as I've liked. I've only seen about three of them, but I've liked what I've seen so far. The very first one was a Danish monster movie called Reptilicus, which even without the Mystery Science Theater commentary, it's still a pretty fun movie to watch because the special effects are so terrible, and it's just I've never seen a Danish monster movie before, so it was kind of a refreshing change. The second episode I watched, Cry Wilderness, this ranks right up there among the most jaw-droppingly inept movies ever featured on Mystery Science Theater. It's this weird movie from the 80s about a kid who goes looking for his father in the forest and runs into Bigfoot, and there are a bunch of weird characters. There's like a Native American guide who pretty much laughs at everything, and there's this secret government agent, I think, this high-strung guy. I didn't really understand that part, but he's the villain in all this, and there are weird scenes where the kid runs into Bigfoot, gives him big hugs, and they play sappy music, and a lot of stock footage of animals and nature footage. It's a pretty batshit crazy kids movie, but the commentary on it is pretty hilarious. I will say even though the commentary is good, and I think McGill said the exact same thing to me, I kind of don't like the voice on Tom Servo because it just sounds kind of drastically different from the voice of the original Servo. I know they couldn't get Kevin Murphy back, but I kind of wish they had gotten more of a sound alike. It kind of reminds me of the very, very first Mystery Science Theater episodes where Servo had this more like conservative newscaster S voice in it. Feels pretty jarring to watch them, and this one I kind of wish it was different, but I'm looking forward to catching up on more of them because they have some more crazy movies. I'm looking forward to seeing the episode on Star Crash because that is one of the all-time best movies, and I'm just happy to see Mystery Science Theater back. It's kind of like a foolproof concept where it's like the whole concept is just so much fun that no matter who you get to do it, it's going to be enjoyable.
So, I mean, you've pretty much summed up most of my thoughts as well. I totally agree that this is like their B-plus material. This is really good Mystery Science Theater stuff, but we have yet to encounter an episode on the level of something like Mitchell, for example, which is one of the all-time classics. But, I mean, to be fair, this is only one new season, and those, you know, top-notch Hall of Fame Mystery Science Theater episodes are sort of few and far between in the original series anyway. Most of them are about the same quality as these new episodes, and I am totally okay with that. The voice of Tom Servo, yeah, it does bug me, but that is pretty much my only complaint about this. I love the movies they've chosen, just really great ones. There's like a Roger Corman disaster movie, Avalanche. There is, of course, Star Crash. There's some Hercules in here. It's just really terrific. They did a bang-up job choosing the perfect films. And some of them are not actually terrible. Like, there's one called The Time Travelers that is not terrible, but it is just so bizarre and campy that it is perfect for Mystery Science Theater. More than
yes.
Go ahead.
Yes, I actually watched The Time Travelers last night. It's hardly the worst movie they've shown on there, but it's weird.
It's so strange, but it's just loads of fun to watch it with Jonah, the new host, and the bots. But more so even than the movies and the riffing, I think like everything surrounding the movies has improved vastly. Obviously, they have access to better special effects and a better budget for these episodes. So the new models look fantastic. And the new door sequence, I think, is the best thing about this revival. They do this really terrific, like 2001 A Space Odyssey kind of trick, where all the doors are also the shapes of these different rooms on the Satellite of Love. It just looks fantastic, and it is detailed enough to be impressive, but obviously made of cardboard enough that it's charmingly cheap. Like, they nailed the revival on the aesthetic. I think that Jonah is a great host. He's really funny and just sort of easygoing, lackadaisical kind of character. And the musical numbers that they have on this revival, I think, are some of the best of the entire series. Robin, you mentioned the episode Reptilicus, the Danish monster movie. That leads to this whole musical number where Jonah and the bots sing about how every country has a monster they're afraid of. And they go around the world just listing all these monsters from pop culture and folklore in all these different countries. It's terrific. It's catchy and really, really fun.
And they also do it in one unbroken take, I believe. So I was just so impressed how well they choreographed that.
Yeah, I love that they've maintained the sort of live TV broadcast feeling of the original Mystery Science Theater, where like the host segments and the invention exchanges and all that, they were usually done without any editing and just that one medium shot, you know, almost like a newscaster style shot. And so they've maintained that in the revival, and they even have commercial breaks for no reason because there are no commercials on Netflix. But I kind of love them as well. Like, the aesthetic is spot on. The mad scientists, here played by Felicia Day and Patton Oswalt. I mean, this may sound blasphemous, but I think they are the best mad scientists we've had yet. The comedic timing on their segments is perfect. They're short. They don't overstay their welcome. And I really like the dynamic between them, between Kinga Forrester and TV's son of TV's Frank. I just think they do a great job. So all around, I am completely thrilled by Mystery Science Theater 3000 The Return, and I can't wait for more. Oh, and I didn't even mention, they have this clever little thing where they have guest cameos on many episodes, and the cameos are completely charming. Robin, I don't know, have you gotten to any of the cameos yet?
I saw a few of them, but I know there are more to come as the series goes along.
So, an early one that's great is Neil Patrick Harris turns up, and he's playing this, space magician, a space David Copperfield, who Kinga Forrester has a big crush on, and they do, a little musical bit about what it's like to have a romance over Wi-Fi, basically. It's hilarious stuff. So, I'm totally thrilled. I have, three more episodes to watch, and so far, I don't think there's been a dud in the bunch. There's yet to be, the big standout, but it's incredibly entertaining overall.
Yes, excellent. Thumbs way up. It's they've done so many revivals recently of, old TV series, but it looks like they nailed it on this one. And as far as what else I've been up to, I've seen all three episodes of Better Call Saul, but I guess I won't talk too much about it because it doesn't sound like TK has seen all of them, but it's been really strong so far. I really love how they're building up the rivalry between Jimmy and Chuck, and I'd say the second episode overall was the best one because it had a big revelation in that episode, but I don't want to spoil it, so we can talk more about it later on when everybody is caught up. I also want to mention that I've released a new Cracked article, actually this week called 5 Truly Breathtaking Moments in Celebrity Hypocrisy. And of course, a new Trail Went Cold episode. This week's episode was pretty popular because it's a classic unsolved mysteries case about the murder of a woman named Terry McClure, and her son Tim was the prime suspect. And if you've been to the website, you'll see that on the night she was murdered, he posed for a photo with the biggest mullet in history. So it's one of our most popular downloads yet, and I think that Tim McClure's mullet is a big draw for us. So it's definitely one of the most discussed episodes that I've had so far, so be sure to check it out. And I don't think I've had a chance to mention this yet because we haven't recorded it in a few weeks, but a couple weeks ago, one of the cases I featured on the Trail Went Cold, the disappearance of a woman named Pamela Butler, was actually solved, and her boyfriend, who was the prime suspect, was arrested for her murder. I have no idea if the podcast had any relation to that at all, but it was pretty cool to see one of our cases got solved. And the weirdest thing is that when I shared this news on Twitter, the tweet was liked by Patricia Arquette, completely out of left field. So I have no idea if an Academy Award winning actress listens to The Trail Went Cold, but if she does, that would be amazing. So Patricia Arquette, if you're listening, thank you very much.
So I think we can officially say Robin's famous, right? This is it, right? Patricia Arquette is retweeting Robin. He's famous, right?
Exactly, yeah, I'm famous. In fact, you're going to have to pay me to appear on this. I'm so famous. You're going to have to book me ahead of time.
So this will be the final episode of The Trail Went Cold, the shows from the back row.
Yes. I'm too big. I've gotten too big. My head is inflated so big. No, just kidding. And anyway, that's all I've been up to.
I have also been watching Better Call Saul. I agree with you, Robin. The second episode is probably the best of the three I have seen. And without spoiling anything, I'll just say that the rivalry between Chuck and Jimmy, this has to be one of the best written, like, family rivalries on TV right now. Because it's one of those things, you know, we've discussed it when we do our episodes recapping the seasons of Better Call Saul, where we talk about how brilliant it is that the rivalry between Chuck and Jimmy, the way it's written, it's like Chuck is conniving and he's devious and he's like, you hate him, but he's kind of justified in some of his actions too. It's really just fantastic. It's this very tangled web where you hate both of these guys for different reasons, but you also sympathize and empathize with them for different reasons too. It's really fascinating, incredibly well written, and I continue to love Better Call Saul. And I'll touch on Fargo, but again, no spoilers, because I especially don't want to spoil this for TK, who has been a huge fan of Fargo since he watched the first season of it. But I'll say that Fargo is off to a strong start, and they're laying the groundwork for this season that will inevitably involve the same themes that we've seen in previous seasons and in the Coen Brothers movie. You know, crime and money and blackmail, things like that. So they're setting all of that up. You can see how they're setting all of that up. But for me, the big delight was the cast. Because I knew some of the cast. I think they announced, you know, like Ewan McGregor, they announced well in advance. They said he'd be playing twins. This much I knew. I knew Mary Elizabeth Winstead was going to be on it. But then it just kept going. All of these familiar faces kept popping up. For example, Scoot McNairy. I had no idea Scoot McNairy was in this show. And it seems like he's going to be playing a major role for a lot of it. David Thewlis also turns up. Michael Stuhlbarg. I had no idea he was on it. And I think there were even more, but I'll leave it there, especially because I can't remember the other ones. It was just one of those things where almost every shot there was some new actor where I was like, I didn't know they were in this. I can't believe they're in this. Oh, and it just made me so excited for the rest of the season. So, I mean, TK, you gotta watch it. Go watch Fargo because it's great, and I want to talk to you about it. Ewan McGregor is doing a really great job playing these twins, I have to say. So
I'm really looking forward to it whenever I get into it.
Yeah, I'm just excited to see what is to come based on this first episode. It was quite the delight to get back into it, and I'm also delighted because it feels like good TV is back. Kind of felt like for a while there wasn't much on, but now we got Better Call Saul, we have Fargo, Game of Thrones is coming up, Samurai Jack, another thing I've been watching that's fantastic, is on right now, and Rick and Morty is impending too. We've already had the first episode of the new season, so hey, it's a good time to be watching TV right now. Other things I've watched, like Robin, I watched The Fate of the Furious, and I'll talk about that in our main discussion of The Rock. I also watched a couple of other movies that were not good. We'll talk about them now. The first one I watched knowing it would be terrible, and I watched it out of sheer morbid curiosity. That is the Walter Hill film, The Assignment. This is the one that Robin has mentioned, where Michelle Rodriguez plays a man who's like a mercenary assassin. And because he kills someone related to Sigourney Weaver, who is this, like, insane doctor, decides to get revenge by performing a sex change operation on Michael Rodriguez? I can't remember what the name of Michelle Rodriguez's character was when she was a man. So it's just Michelle Rodriguez the whole time. And as Robin mentioned, when Michelle Rodriguez plays this male character, they have her in a fake-as-hell-looking beard. And then they do, I'm guessing, a combination of CGI and prosthetics to give you, like, this almost nightmarish shot of, like, flat-chested, masculine Michelle Rodriguez with a penis which the camera, like, does, like, close-up on. And it's one of the most bizarre shots of the film, not only because it's going, that's Michelle Rodriguez and here is her penis, but also because for all that they tried to make her front appear like that of a man, her ass was still very much a woman's ass. It was still, like, Michelle Rodriguez's curvaceous butt. When I told TK this, he said, well, you can't hide dat ass. And it's so true. So the whole scene just feels so uncanny and strange because they've done such a weird, almost Frankenstein-like job of trying to make Michelle Rodriguez into not only a man, but like a naked man showing full frontal nudity. Whoa, it's weird. It's just, it doesn't work. And the whole movie just feels dumb and exploitative. I could see, you know, apparently Walter Hill has wanted to make this movie since, like, the 70s, I think. I could see it being made in the 70s and being kind of like a pulpy, exploitation thriller. It would almost work, especially with that, like, 1970s film grain and the color palette and the clothing. It would almost work as being, like, this boiler movie of that era. But in the modern age, this is utterly tasteless. It's just so tasteless and so poorly handled. None of it is convincing. The writing is really quite bad. And something that really stood out to me as being terrible was that Walter Hill tries to apply this energetic kind of editing with a lot of, like, you know, Guy Ritchie is a good touchstone for this, with where, like, there are these wipes and these, like, really fast sort of split screens and things. Walter Hill definitely tries to apply that aesthetic here, but here's the thing about that aesthetic. It only works when your movie is energetic. You know, you can have hyperkinetic editing when the film itself is very hyperkinetic and fast-paced, but The Assignment is not fast-paced. It's dead slow at certain parts, and so it just doesn't work. Not even in the construction of the film does it work. It's hard to believe that a director whose work I have really enjoyed in the past made such a dud and such a, honestly, it just feels like an incompetently made movie in a lot of ways. And completely tone deaf on issues of gender. My God. Like, to an unbelievable degree. So, major thumbs down. Even as a curiosity piece, I don't recommend this. It wasn't even very entertaining. It was just bad, and you just feel kind of gross watching it. Just no.
And also mention the weird sex scene of Michelle Rodriguez as a man having sex with another woman. That was weird.
Oh, yeah, it's very strange. Like, I don't know. Maybe if they had made Michelle Rodriguez into a more convincing man, like someone who was actually trying to be a man. It reminded me of an episode of Orphan Black where Tatiana Maslany, she plays a variety of clones on that show. So it's her in many different roles as many different characters. And I praise her acting ability, because she does clearly have range. All of the different characters she portrays are distinct, even though she portrays a lot of them. But there was an episode, I can't remember, it was like the first or second season, where she appears as a transgendered clone, and it's just Tatiana Maslany with a shitty soul patch glued to her chin. It's just, I don't know. I feel like if you're gonna do that, especially because it's such a sensitive topic, just put a little fucking effort into it, you know? Put some effort into it. You don't have to give us a close-up of Michelle Rodriguez's penis. Just try a little sensitivity and put a little more effort into making it believable. That's all I ask. So, I don't know. The Assignment.
One more thing I'll have to mention is that when I saw The Fast and the Furious, all I had was that penis scene in my head whenever Michelle Rodriguez was on screen. It's kind of ruined her for me almost, because whenever I see her now, all I think back to is that scene in The Assignment. So if it has a legacy, the movie, I guess that's it, because I will never be able to take Michelle Rodriguez seriously again, I think.
Yeah, you know, I actually think her shitty fake beard in The Assignment is even more egregious, because it is just so obviously fake. Like, it looked like the kind of beard that you would buy buy at a Halloween outlet. Like, it's just not, it is not a Hollywood quality effect. Boo the assignment. You know, when it comes to the end of this year, when we talk about the worst films of the year, it's entirely possible that I'll choose some other movie that is more comedically dumb, you know, bad in an entertaining way. But the assignment, in terms of actual quality, this is a strong contender for the worst movie of this year. And the other film, also bad, that I saw was the Ryan Reynolds, Jake Gyllenhaal, Rebecca Ferguson space movie Life. And Life is very clearly marketed as being something along the lines of Alien meets Gravity, where it's trying to give us these, you know, more modern day, like present day astronauts, and they are encountering hostile extraterrestrial life aboard a space station. So it really is, it's like Alien meets Gravity is very much sort of the pitch of this one. And I didn't expect much. It got, like, lukewarm reviews when it came out, so I didn't expect it to be bad, but my God, this was a really bad movie, guys. And the reason that it is bad, more than anything, like, if just as a generic, you know, they discovered alien life and it's evil, just as a generic, like, monster movie like that, I guess it's fine, it's passable, but the thing that just killed this movie for me is it is one of those movies where you, the viewer, like any viewer, you are smarter than these characters. And these characters are astronauts. Like, they are, and scientists. They are supposed to be brilliant minds. But no, we're, everybody here on this podcast, we are smarter than the characters in Life. And here's another thing, too, is Life rips off Alien quite a bit. The characters in Alien are not the smartest people, but they have an excuse because Alien is set in a universe where space trucking is a thing. These characters in Alien are just like truckers. They're hauling cargo across the galaxy. But in Life, they are astronauts and scientists, and they make incredibly stupid decisions that are just inconceivable. So the example that I like to give when people have asked me about this, and how is Life? The movie, Life the movie. Here's the thing. You've all encountered, Robin, you've encountered cats in your life, right? You've met a cat? Yeah. What happens if you wave your finger at a cat?
The cat is not going to react very well.
No, the cat will probably swat at your finger. It'll probably attack your finger. And that's even if it's a friendly cat. Even friendly cats like to attack, like, someone waving their finger. Now, a cat is a domesticated animal that you can encounter all the time. I own cats. I encounter them on a daily basis. And I know better than to wave my finger at a cat. When the astronauts in Life discover alien life, they find life from Mars, literally the first thing they do, and this is not an exaggeration, is they poke it with their finger. They wave their finger at this alien life and they poke it. And of course, it attacks them. Guys, come on. And so the alien life attacks the guy who pokes it and, like, breaks his hand. They lock down the lab that he's in. And then, of course, the first thing that happens is Ryan Reynolds jumps up and he's like, screw protocol, I'm going in there. It's that kind of movie. It's the kind of movie where it's just like cliche after cliche. It's predictable, and the characters are stupid. And I'm going to spoil the ending, because I don't care if you see this movie or not. It's dumb. I think it's a really bad movie. So here's the spoiler, the ending of the movie Life. So just like Alien, they try to blow the alien out of the airlock. And then the two remaining survivors, Jake Gyllenhaal and Rebecca Ferguson, they get into escape pods to eject. This all sounds very familiar, right? Because it's like Alien. But oh no, on Jake Gyllenhaal's escape pod, the alien has survived and it attacks him. So now, it's hard to explain this because it's a purely visual trick. They try to pull a twist. And so what you see is you see Jake Gyllenhaal and Rebecca Ferguson get into their escape pods. You see the escape pods blast off from the space station. Then you see inside Jake Gyllenhaal's escape pod, the alien comes out of nowhere and attacks him. Then you see the two escape pods, and one of them is spinning off into space, and one of them is careening into Earth's atmosphere. And all this time, we cut inside the escape pods, and, you know, everything's going nuts. Rebecca Ferguson is wrestling at the controls. Jake Gyllenhaal is fighting with the alien. One of the escape pods flies off into space, and the other one crash lands in the ocean. But oh no, big twist! For all that we thought that Jake Gyllenhaal was the pod being flown off into space with the alien, it was Rebecca Ferguson, and Jake Gyllenhaal landed on Earth, and now the alien's going to infect the Earth. The end.
Whoopee.
This is a really bad movie. I was kind of floored by how bad I found this film. Just dumb decision after dumb decision by the characters, and it's such a blatant ripoff of Alien that I'd rather, like, just go watch Alien. At least Alien has a scary alien. The alien in life just looks like a big starfish. Like, it just looks like a really, like a space starfish. And what's more, they have this gimmick early on where, you know, Martian life is discovered, and so back on Earth, a big contest is held where an elementary school class got to pick the name of the alien, and they named it Calvin. So it's a space starfish named Calvin that is stalking our stupid astronauts, as opposed to a terrifying nameless space bug, the Xenomorph, stalking a bunch of space truckers on the coolest ship, you know, that had been designed at that point for movies. So, yeah, just go watch Aliens.
Whose bright idea was that? To get kids to choose a name, because they had to be trolling when they chose Calvin, right?
Calvin. Man, I guess. just skip it. Just go watch Gravity and Alien back to back, and you will enjoy that a hell of a lot more than life. I can't quite believe, like, I kind of wonder if life had been made maybe a couple years ago and then shelved. And then Ryan Reynolds had a huge hit with Deadpool, so then they were like, oh, well, we gotta release this one. Because, you know, Deadpool, for all that I didn't like it, was a really big hit, and this kind of feels like Ryan Reynolds taking a step down and being in an utterly, like, I think that life is probably worse than Deadpool. I think that there are a lot of things that life does that I just hate so much more than I hated about Deadpool. So skip it. Avoid it. And the assignment, too. These are bad movies. You've been warned. And that's all I've been up to. So now let's talk about Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And I thought it was, you know, initially we decided on this topic because The Fate of the Furious is out in theaters now, and that the Fast and Furious franchise, it has taken on so many stars, but, you know, one of the biggest names right now among the cast is, of course, The Rock. But when I started thinking about the topic, I realized it's kind of great because The Rock has risen to fame very, like, his career has a very clear trajectory that we can chart over the course of our lives. As we'll talk about in a moment, I vividly remember when I became aware of The Rock, because it was like 1999. It was right when I was in high school. So, I find it really interesting because this one is very obvious. There's very little of The Rock's career that you cannot find easily. But, maybe before we, well, actually, I guess these things are tied together. So I'll start by asking the question, when did you first become aware of The Rock? And that will lead into my next inquiry, which is towards Robin, which is to talk about, you know, give us some insight into The Rock's wrestling career. So, Robin, was it wrestling that brought The Rock to your attention first?
Oh, yes, definitely. And I'm going to give a little teaser here, but I did not like The Rock at first when I first saw him in wrestling, but that's an interesting story that I'll share.
And TK, when did you become aware of The Rock first?
In adverts for The Scorpion King, I think it's the first time.
And for me, it was the role of The Scorpion King, but it was actually when he played The Scorpion King in The Mummy Returns. Robin and I have talked about how we're sort of unabashed Stephen Sommers fans. And I especially loved the first Mummy movie, with Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz, and, you know, it's the Stephen Sommers film. So I was excited for The Mummy Returns, the much anticipated sequel, and I have such vivid memories of the build-up to The Mummy Returns, and more than it being a sequel to The Mummy, the thing everybody was talking about is how it was the first big screen appearance of Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Everybody was talking about it. And I remember seeing the movie, which, frankly, I don't think is especially good. It's nowhere near as good as the first Mummy movie from Stephen Sommers. And I was also surprised that most of The Rock's role is like the first 5 minutes, and the rest is him as this really badly rendered CGI creation. So, The Mummy Returns, it's just so clear in my mind, and I can remember every film thereafter where The Rock was the star, and people are like, oh, The Rock's in this movie. And, you know, I saw, I mean, as we'll talk about, I have just these vivid memories charting The Rock's rise to fame. But even before The Mummy Returns, of course, The Rock had built up this reputation in wrestling. So, Robin, why don't you tell us that story about why you hated The Rock at first?
Well, what's funny is that pretty much everyone hated The Rock, because the way they started out his career is that he was the first third-generation wrestler in WWF history, because his grandfather, High Chief Peter Maivia, was a wrestler, and his father, Rocky Johnson, was a wrestler. And they started him out, and they made him this happy, smiling, goody-two-shoes baby face that was always talking about, oh, you have 110% every time, that he was so bland and so lame that everyone just booed him like crazy. So they kind of had to retinker him. So they turned him into a heel, into a bad guy. And Rock went off and he took acting lessons. And suddenly he just ballooned. Like, he just gained like a boatload of charisma because he was so good at playing a bad guy. And just so good. Got so good at playing like a bad guy that they eventually started cheering him again. So they had to turn him into a good guy, a baby face again. And he just rocketed up to the stratosphere like so quick that he became the number two star behind Stone Cold Steve Austin. And then when Stone Cold had to go out for a year because of a neck injury, The Rock became the top guy because he just had like amazing charisma, amazing timing, and he invented like so many catchphrases, like the term SmackDown. He just invented that phrase in a promo, and it's a term everybody uses today that it's even been added to the dictionary. And he would go out on live TV and cut like all these promos with all these catchphrases with like pitch perfect timing, and he never blew his lines or anything. Like he just nailed it and stuff. And it got to the point where people thought this guy might be too big for wrestling because he has so much charisma. And I think his major turning point is when he guest hosted Saturday Night Live in 2000, and he just nailed it during all the sketches that I think people in Hollywood kind of looked at him and said, wow, this guy might be good in movies. He could be like a really good actor. And it eventually got to the point where he only became a part-time wrestler, started off where he would still wrestle, take a couple months off to make movies, and then come back. But it got to the point where he was getting so many roles that he became a full-time movie star. My personal experience, I've seen him in live and in-person wrestling many times. I actually got to see him fight Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 18 in the Sky Dome, which was pretty cool because it was the biggest star of the previous generation versus the biggest star of that generation. And the crowd was just going apeshit for it. So I've had a lot of cool experiences watching The Rock, but it eventually got to the point where he had to make acting a full-time thing. But he was just, when he was at his peak, he was just so good. Like he could put on good matches, cut great interviews, and he just had so much charisma that you knew he was going to be bigger than wrestling.
So, you've sort of addressed my follow-up to that, but I'll ask it straight out. Why do you think that he rose to acting fame where others have failed? You know, we don't see, like, John Cena in a lot of movies, right? What really separated The Rock?
I think he just had more range because, like, the other example, like Hulk Hogan, back in the 80s and 90s tried to go off and start his movie career, but he would choose bad projects like Mr. Nanny, and even though he was a good actor in wrestling standards, he was not a good actor by movie standards, whereas The Rock just showed like a good range. Like, he would do action movies, but he would also do kind of like cheesy kiddie comedies and be surprisingly charming in them, and he would do stuff like Be Cool, where he's playing like a gay bodyguard, and then he would also do indie films like Southland Tales. Like, he kind of showed that he had more range than your average wrestler, because for wrestling, they teach you how to turn up the cheese level to like very high, whereas Rock knew how to balance it out, where he could translate his charisma to acting but not make it like too over the top like it would be in wrestling. He just kind of somehow found that perfect balance, I think, to become a full-time actor.
Yeah, that self-deprecation is very much part of The Rock's public persona. Like, he's clearly not afraid to make fun of himself. And I think that that's probably one of the things that really gives him a leg up on other actors wrestlers trying to be actors. You know, I mentioned we don't see John Cena in a lot of movies, but he's been in movies. He's not very good. Stone Cold Steve Austin has also been in movies. Again, just not really that good. But The Rock clearly, like, he's got range, he can be really funny, and he's not afraid to make himself the butt of a joke. And I guess that's what sets him apart. And it is interesting to see, again, to chart the course of his career and see, like, what they tried to make him and then what he fell into and at what points he decided to sort of step outside the public perception of him. So I'm going to say here, like, I'm going to list some films. None of these movies are among my favorite movies that The Rock was in, but all of these movies I actually did see in theaters, and I have these vivid memories of watching him. And so clearly, from the start, they were trying to make him into more of an action hero with things like, you know, the Scorpion King, or Walking Tall, or The Rundown. You know, these are movies where he's basically trying to be the next Schwarzenegger. And what's interesting is that they even do a gag like that in The Rundown, where Schwarzenegger, who was governor at the time, passes by him and goes, like, good luck, as this sort of passing of the torch, saying, like, okay, you have my blessing. But for all that they really tried to make him into this action hero from the start, it wasn't until he started doing more comedic roles that I really started to appreciate him and discover that, like, oh, wow, you know, this guy, there's really something to this guy. So let's talk about the movie, you know, our favorite performances or movies from The Rock. And we'll start with number 3, TK. What is your number 3 most favorite Rock performance or movie?
Now, I was looking through a list of IMDb stuff. Now, I have never seen any of the Fast and Furious films, and I've seen a smattering of films that he's been in. So I apologize. My list is not very extensive, so just I'm going to throw that out there right now. But one of my favorite roles that I really remember him being in most was he was in an episode of Star Trek Voyager where he's the, like, lead gladiator in this alien culture's fighting pit, and he comes out and fights one of the main characters. And it was kind of cool because, like, I hadn't paid a lot of attention to it, but I knew some of his wrestling stuff, and, like, a lot of his moves are all based on his wrestling stuff. It was kind of funny to see him cross over, and that's actually probably one of the first big times I was exposed to him aside from the Scorpion King films. But it was just funny that, like, you know, the doors open, and like in every gladiatorial film, the doors open and he steps out into the light, and I'm like, hey, it's The Rock. That's awesome.
And
he's on Star Trek.
In typical Star Trek fashion, his makeup is just a piece on his forehead.
Yeah, it's great. But I got a big kick out of that, and I thought it was funny that he could at least, like you were talking about, feel the self-appreciation just to step into this, like, goofy warrior role. I thought it was fun.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a hell of a lot to say on that. I saw that episode of Voyager, and at the time, I, of course, had no idea who he was. But it's funny because it's another one of those things where it's like, well, obviously we'll get a famous wrestler to do this wrestling cameo on Star Trek. in a way, you know, Star Trek is almost like Miami Vice in a lot of ways, where a lot of actors, you know, will do like a cameo on it before they get really famous on one of the various Star Trek series. And so this to me is akin to like Steve Buscemi being on an episode of Miami Vice, where it's kind of an obvious role for him to get his start in. But in a way, it's kind of fun too, because it's Star Trek, so it's a little bit nerdier than most. And it's interesting to see that sort of nerdier, goofy side of The Rock come out as his career progresses too. I don't know, Robin, did you see this episode of Star Trek?
I never did, no, but it is interesting to see that he did it in 1999 before his Saturday Night Live appearance, so I think this would have been maybe his first, like, experiment with acting, but obviously it paid off for him.
Well, Robin, what's your number three pick?
I'm going to choose The Rundown. That's one of his earliest ones, but it's still one of my favorite movies that he's done. He did it in like 2003 when he was still alternating between wrestling and acting. And I think this was the first one where you could really see him working as a leading man, because The Scorpion King, there wasn't really a lot to that role. But here he kind of plays like this charming, like bounty hunter role where he's put in like a buddy situation with Sean William Scott. And they have a lot of chemistry together, I thought, in this one. And I do love that moment where, we're at the beginning of the film where he walks into a club and Arnold Schwarzenegger passes by him and says, good luck. And you kind of see, like, his more self-deprecating side in that opening scene where he has to, like, he plays like a loan shark, I think, who has to get money from, like, this football player who's got these gambling debts. And he finds out, like, the entire, like, all of his teammates are in there. And then he goes on the cell phone and he says, but no, I don't want to get in a fight in them because I really like this team. I want them to repeat this year. I don't want to hurt them and stuff. And then he reluctantly goes out there and beats the crap out of them, even though he's a legitimate fan of all these players, I thought was kind of charming. But the movie itself is a lot of fun. I particularly like Christopher Walken as the villain, where he gets these weird Walken-esque moments, like a scene where he has to explain the concept of the Tooth Fairy to like all these natives in the jungle who don't understand it. He just goes, do I have to explain to you the concept of the Tooth Fairy? It just seems like one of those weird walking moments where you feel like he just came up with it right there on the set and they just filmed it and decided to put it into the movie. But it is pretty fun.
Then some producer behind the camera was like, The Rock is the Tooth Fairy, huh?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. It's like, I wonder if somebody saw that moment and thought, this could be a great project for The Rock a couple years down the road. But he's really likable and charming in this one, and he showed himself to be a great action hero. And it actually holds up much better than a lot of his earlier efforts, I think. And I kind of helped cemented him to show that he was very good at doing action and comedy and had a lot of potential as a star.
It's a fine movie, and he's likable in it. And the thing that stood out most for me, it's been a number of years since I've seen The Rundown, but the thing that stood out most for me was definitely the action sequences and the fights that The Rock was in. And of course, it only makes sense that with his background in wrestling, he could do these amazing pieces of fight choreography. It's one of those rare talents where it's just like a genuinely likable and good, solid actor who is also just incredibly muscular and capable of these amazing feats of strength and agility. So it is sort of a perfect combination. Personally, I just don't find The Rundown to be that memorable of an action movie, but I remember it being a really enjoyable one at the time, and just another great showcase for The Rock's talents, especially one that comes early in his career. So my number three, and it's funny that my list is going to seem like it's backwards. You guys are probably going to be a little perplexed with the way I have ordered my list, because here's like a spoiler for you, but my number one pick is actually a movie that I dislike more than my movies for numbers two and three, but I think it's The Rock's best performance. So it's this sort of disproportionate thing. And as a tangent, I did notice when I was putting my list together that The Rock's filmography can kind of be divided into these two types of films, where like, sad to say, I think he has made a lot of bad movies, but he is always so likable that it doesn't really matter. And the movies where he really stretches his acting chops, like, shows off his range, they tend to be movies that they themselves are not great. He's great in them, but the movies themselves aren't very good. Whereas a lot of the movies that he's been in that I think are good movies, he delivers just a very sort of normal, likable performance. Like, I could not distinguish for you his character from the Fast and Furious movies with his character from, like, G.I. Joe Retaliation. Or even The Rundown, really. Those three characters are not extremely different. They're all just basically The Rock. And often that's good enough. But it's these bad movies that he's been in where he tries out something new and he ends up being great. He ends up being the highlight of them. So, all that to say, my number three is Moana, which is a perfectly fine movie. It's a really enjoyable movie. I think that it's great. Like, this is the Rock being in a family movie, and it works. There's a really good role for him as Maui, this demigod, who's sort of reminiscent of the genie from Aladdin. He's really energetic, he's sarcastic and quippy, and he's got some fun, upbeat musical numbers. And hey, you know what? The Rock can sing all right. He's not, like, an amazing singer, but his number is a really catchy, memorable one, and it's actually one of the songs from Moana that I find myself humming more often than any of the others. So, I think The Rock is really well cast here, and he's got a good voice. Like, he's got a really great voice to him. So he does just a fine job performing this character. It's almost like the culmination of his career, where he gets to, you know, be the comic sidekick in a Disney film, and he does a really good job. And he does, like, a song number in the middle of it too. So Moana is my number three. What do you guys think? I think it's The Rock's first Oscar-nominated movie.
Yes, that's true. And it was really cool to see him at the Oscars this year presenting, because it was just so surreal to see a professional wrestler up there at the Oscars. But I still haven't seen Moana yet, but I hear it's one of his more charming performances. And I remember they were talking about him, like, on the Nostalgia Critic a couple weeks ago, when they were talking about actors who use their own voices and aren't very good. And they were talking about, well, The Rock isn't a great singer in Moana, but he delivers it with such enthusiasm and energy that you forgive him for it and you really like him. So he just kind of has that infectious energy, I hear, in that movie that had made people endear him to his musical number in it.
Yeah, they're really smart with the song that they give to The Rock, because they don't ask him to, like, you know, run the gamut of his vocal range. It's a pretty simplistic tune, but again, he's just, like, so into it. He's clearly having a lot of, just a great time. I bet while he was recording that, he was probably thinking, like, oh, my kids get to watch this and they're just gonna love it. Like, he has this very infectious enthusiasm to it that, to me, that was really the thing that made the movie, was him as Maui. I thought he was just one of the best parts because of the energy he brought to it. TK, you saw Moana, correct?
Moana's actually my number one role here.
Ah, interesting. So I do have the inverse of you.
I do, but I really, like you were saying, it's You're Welcome, is I catch myself, like, humming that all the time. And it is one of the catches. I liked his voice work, but like you were saying, it's obvious he's having an absolute blast with the role. And even when he was at the Oscars this year, very briefly talking about it, I thought he was proud of it. You know, he had a really good time with it. And I was watching an interview with him talking about how he apparently cried in the theater when he saw the film.
This guy, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
It's really something. It feels like such a rarity that we get an actor who is so multi-talented, and there's something kind of warm and cuddly about him as well. Like, he could kick your ass, but you'd still come away smiling from it. It's really something. Something else that I found, so The Rock's casting in Moana made me wonder why it had to be animated. It's sort of an odd question to, you know, it's Disney, of course it has to be animated, but here's a case where, like, The Rock is singing his own song, and he is an enormous, muscular Polynesian man. Why not just make this movie? If you look at the actress who plays Moana, she looks just like Moana. So the casting of her and The Rock in this film, I mean, it's a fine movie, but it really made me go like, why didn't they just make this movie live action? Because those actors could obviously play these roles. Like, Dwayne Johnson looks like a demigod, right? He's enormous. So I'm a bit puzzled as to why they decided to make it animated instead of live action. But, you know, maybe they're just going to wait a couple of years and do one of those live action Disney remakes and get back The Rock to play Maui. So Moana, my number three. TK, what is your number two?
Okay, so my number two is actually, again, kind of a cameo role, but it's delightful to watch. And it's like the opening 15 minutes of the movie The Other Guys, where him and Samuel A. Jackson play like the city's top cops who do like an unbelievable amount of property damage while catching criminals for very small things. Have you guys seen this?
I have seen The Other Guys, yeah.
Yeah. Robin?
Yes, I've seen it too.
Okay, so I'm gonna spoil the opening 10 minutes of this, but like, there's this hysterical point where they get to like, they're chasing these villains who have robbed a bank, and him and Sammy J are running up to the top floor of this building, and the bad guys have a zip line and they cut it so they can't be followed, and the two of them just look at each other and they're like, well, you know what I'm thinking. What I'm thinking, yeah, just aim for the bushes, and they jump off the top of this building, and. There's nothing there. They just land and die on the sidewalk. And I think it's so hysterically funny because it's nothing you expect out of nowhere. But like, the lead up, it doesn't show that they're the smartest cops, that they are the ones who get the most quote unquote airtime. And I think it's just, I just really enjoy The Rock in that cameo. He's like this confident, full of yourself, like takes no prisoners cop. And we get like 10 minutes of it, and it's just done in stupidest way possible, and I find that goofily endearing. I think it's funny.
Well, they're clearly riffing on like Lethal Weapon, basically, even though Riggs and Murtaugh are not exactly as exaggeratedly, you know, over the top huge the way The Rock or Samuel L. Jackson are. They're clearly like riffing on that type of buddy cop thing, and it's just the perfect little cameo role for those two guys. It really is. And the fact that, you know, they die in this ridiculous way, falling victim to their own action movie cliches, is really funny. And even though it's just a cameo, you know, you could say The Rock is the reason for the title of this movie, because those are the guys, and then Wahlberg and Will Ferrell, they're the other guys. Robin, what do you think of The Other Guys?
Yeah, I mean, Other Guys isn't a great movie, and I almost think one of the problems is that him and Samuel L. Jackson are so great that you almost want the entire movie to be about them, because they pretty much steal the movie in the first 15 minutes, but you can't really object too much because their death scene is so awesome and is definitely the highlight of the entire film. But, yeah, as I was watching it, all I could think was, man, I really want The Rock and Samuel L. Jackson to do a real cop buddy movie together, based entirely on them, because they do it together so well. But, yeah, even though it's just a cameo, it is a great role for him.
And that's why your number two is almost the same, Central Intelligence with The Rock and Kevin Hart.
No, it isn't.
No.
But actually, I just want to, it's not one of my favorites, but that is also an example for me where it's not a good movie, but I thought The Rock was great in it, though. Did you guys watch it?
I didn't. It even came out when I was working at a movie theater, so I could have seen it for free, but I just had no interest. Was it good?
It wasn't good, but it's a really stupid movie, but he was so good in it because he played like a character who was like fat and really insecure when he was a kid and bullied on, and then he grows up to be this buff guy, but he's still like a very insecure guy and stuff who's very sensitive about people bullying and stuff, and he plays it so well because he just wants Kevin Hart to be his friend and stuff, even though like the guy used to pick on him and stuff in high school, and it's just so endearing and stuff. But it's so funny because they pretty much end the action aspect of it with 20 minutes left in the movie. And the entire climax is him and Kevin Hart going to the high school reunion and him being voted prom king. And he actually is so excited about it to be voted prom king, even though he's this giant muscular guy now, but he still is thinking back to when he was picked on in high school. So he is definitely the highlight of the movie, but it's not a great movie overall.
Well, good to know. Kinda, maybe I'll watch like the best of on YouTube.
It's true. It just kind of shows the enigma where he can star in movies that aren't so great but still be great in them.
And there's so many examples of that too. Like after we get through our lists, I'm definitely going to list off a few where it's like they're not really honorable mentions because the movies aren't good, but he's really fun in all of them.
Yep, that definitely applies here. But my real number two is actually his role as Luke Hobbs in the Fast and the Furious series. And I think my favorite of all of them is Fate of the Furious, which I'm going to talk about now. But as you probably know, he joined the series in Fast 5. And by no coincidence, this is when the series actually started to get fun and good, because I was never a fan of them for the first four movies. But starting with Fast 5, they really started to embrace their stupidity and just get as over-the-top as possible, and that's when they got really fun to watch and started to make, like, boatloads of money. But I've always kind of liked the whole rivalry he's had with, like, Vin Diesel, like, from the start of Fast 5, where they've kind of had this love-hate relationship with each other. And I think Fate of the Furious is kind of the turning point, because they have the whole teaser where, whoa, you're not sure if Vin Diesel is a bad guy, if he's working for the enemy. So technically, now that Paul Walker has died, The Rock has to be the number one good guy in the Fate and the Furious. And I think he pulls it off really well, because they started off his introductory scene as one of those weird, charming ones where he's coaching his daughter's soccer team, and they have this really bizarre moment where he teaches all the girls on the team to do this Samoan dance, which is kind of part of his real life heritage and stuff. And then he talks about how we're going to kick ass and then I'm going to buy you ice cream. And he has an argument with like this agent from the government who's trying to recruit him for an assignment, even though he wants to watch his daughter win the soccer win the big soccer game. And it's oddly charming and stuff. But I'd say the movie Fate and the Furious overall is pretty fun, because it just gets as ridiculous and stupid as possible. I think the climax of this movie, or the highlight of this movie, is the climax, which alternates between a car chase scene in Russia between where the cars have to outrun a nuclear submarine, and it cuts back to Jason Statham trying to rescue a baby on top of a ghost plane in the ocean and having a shootout while carrying a baby. It is just so over the top ridiculous that it's amazing. And I think the best moment is where The Rock dangles out of a vehicle and redirects a nuclear torpedo with his bare hands. Like, that is probably the greatest moment The Rock has ever done in any of his movies, because it is just so ridiculously over the top. And I should mention that Helen Mirren is also in this movie as well, inexplicably. And I really wish she had a much bigger role in this, but just seeing her in one of these movies is enough. I never would have envisioned that when they started this series like 16 years ago, that Helen Mirren would be a cast member in this. But yeah, like, that's what's great about this series, is that they just keep topping themselves from movie to movie. But I think that The Rock and Jason Statham kind of carry this movie, because I think Vin Diesel is just kind of as wooden as usual in this one. But The Rock, his role has been expanded. He plays the main good guy, and he's very likable and charming in this. And he also does some really cool action scenes. And I kind of love his antagonistic relationship with Jason Statham in this one, because they spent the last few movies like fighting each other, but now they kind of have to team up and have this weird chemistry together, and they have this ridiculous climax where they both have to save the day simultaneously. So, yeah, I think The Rock, I give him all the credit in the world that introducing him into this series has somehow made the Fast and the Furious series just so much more enjoyable. And I think that because he's in it, I know they're planning to do a spin-off movie just about his character, and I would really like to see that, because I think that Vin Diesel and the rest of the entourage are kind of the weak links. But if you do a Fast and the Furious movie just with The Rock, I think it's going to be amazing, and I would gladly watch it.
So Hobbs is my number two pick as well, and just in all the Fast and Furious movies where he appears, The Rock is clearly having a blast, and he's great when he's the villain, and he's great when he's the hero. And part of the appeal of this series for me at this point is that it doesn't, like, who are the good guys and the bad guys anymore? These characters have gone from, literally have gone from street racing and stealing DVD players, to hijacking truck convoys, to, like, being secret agents? It's Mission Impossible by way of Gone in 60 Seconds with a bit of Point Break in the beginning. Like, it's just so cartoonish and weird and silly. But I've become just the biggest vocal proponent of the Fast and the Furious movies ever since I did the marathon where I wanted to see what all the fuss was about. And that I marathoned the whole series simply because Furious 7 was one of the best reviewed movies of the year that it came out. And I think it's actually still my favorite. I think The Fate of the Furious is really fun, but I don't think it quite holds a candle to the utter insanity of Furious 7. But yes,
the most awesome moment in Furious 7 is where The Rock is in a hospital with a cast on his arm, and he literally breaks the cast by flexing his muscles to go into battle. That was amazing.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I love that he diverts a torpedo, but that moment with the cast, it's like, it's so small scale compared to all the ridiculous crap that happens in the Fast and Furious movies, but that's my favorite moment with The Rock as Hobbs, is just where he's like, all right, it's go time, and he flexes his arm, and the cast just explodes off of him. It's great. Another great moment from The Fate of the Furious is where, you know, Vin Diesel's the bad guy now, and he throws this sort of cluster bomb into a meeting room, and the thing explodes, and it shoots like these mini grenades everywhere. And The Rock just catches one with his bare hand and throws it away. They know where their bread is buttered. They give The Rock so many of the best moments. In an earlier one, I think it's part 6, maybe it's part 5, but he just picks up like a machine gun, like a chain gun, and walks down a street blasting it away. Man, it's so great.
Oh, that's
great.
In Furious 7 when he leaves the hospital after
that's right.
The cast off.
It's like immediately thereafter. See, this is what I'm talking about. Like, they know what to do. Just give it all to The Rock. Give him all the best moments. So, I mean, The Fate of the Furious, Furious 7, Fast and Furious 6, this ridiculous naming convention. The Rock has absolutely... I mean, maybe it's just coincidence, but I don't think so. I think The Rock is what has made this movie series into just the awesome thing that it is now. It's just so over the top and ridiculous. And, like, every minor role is played by a celebrity now. Helen Mirren is barely in the Fate of the Furious, but when she's in it, she's playing the mother of Jason Statham and Luke Evans, who are both B-player villains from previous movies, turned heroes in this one. Like, it's just like a rabbit hole when you try to describe this. But yeah, The Rock, Hobbs, the Fast and Furious movies... I think these are like this is sort of the role that is truly going to make him an enormous. Well, I guess it already has made him into an enormous star because they're so popular. TK, you got to start watching these, man. And you know what? Okay, Helen Mirren is Jason Statham and Luke Evans' mom. Oy, she's me mom, Gov. Like, come on.
I'll think about it.
Kurt Russell is also in this movie. It's just like, it's insane. But I'll say here what I said to my sister. I went to the movies with my sister not that long ago, and we watched the trailer for The Fate of the Furious. And I said, you know what, you gotta watch these movies because they get great. I'm of the opinion that they only get good around Fast and Furious 6, and you know what? You could probably start there. You could probably skip everything up until part 6 and just enjoy them just as much. So that's my recommendation. TK, try watching just Fast and Furious 6 without context. See what you think.
I'll think about it, guys.
All right, TK, so what's your number one?
My number one's Moana. We already remember?
That's right. Would you care to elaborate on it more, or have you said all there is to say?
No, I think between you and I, we covered everything I had to say about it.
Okay, then. Robin, what's your number one?
Well, my number one is a movie that is kind of a guilty pleasure of mine, even though it wasn't really popular, but everyone agrees that his role in it is great, and that's Pain and Gain by Michael Bay. This is just such a weirdly dark movie because it's about three really unlikable, despicable characters who are complete morons and murder a bunch of people, yet The Rock somehow makes this character strangely likable. And I think it's kind of weird about him is that his character is like this really like sensitive teddy bear and stuff who converts to like Christianity and stuff, but he's also a cokehead and stuff. And when he's on cocaine, he's really capable of doing some like terrible things and stuff. But what's great about it is that like his character, like they kidnap like a very rich guy played by like Tony Shalhoub and have this really stupid extortion scheme and stuff. And it all leads to them like killing and dismembering like a bunch of people and stuff. And like The Rock's character, even though he's this nice guy, he pretty much does the worst of it and stuff, because when he goes on cocaine, he just goes like batshit crazy. But The Rock is just so much fun to watch that you really get caught up in watching what these characters do. And the character is such a moron because there's a moment late in the film where he dismembers like one of his victims and then like grills like their hands on a barbecue in broad daylight. And the movie actually has to put a title card while this is going on saying, just a reminder, this is a true story. This actually happened. Like, it's just mind-blowing to watch just what morons these characters are. But The Rock totally steals the movie, and the scenes where he's like on cocaine and just acting like a maniac, he's just brilliant in them and stuff. So but as Michael Bay movies go, I think this is one of Michael Bay's like most entertaining films overall, just because it is the ultimate black comedy, and you can't really defend it, but I did really enjoy watching it. And I think in large part, I think The Rock plays a big role in that, and it kind of shows his range, because you see both sides of him, both his likable side and his despicable side. And I'm not sure many other actors could have pulled off the role he has as well as he did.
Pain and Gain is in my honorable mentions. And yeah, as you said, Robin, it's sort of a movie that you can't really defend. Like, it's undeniably entertaining, and it's the visual style that Michael Bay applies to it reminded me a lot. In fact, the whole thing reminded me a lot of like Tony Scott movies, with a lot of hypersaturated colors and on like tongue-in-cheek on-screen titles, and also just these crime films with a lot of despicable characters, but that also have this humorous edge to them. The Rock is great. I think the whole principal cast of Mark Wahlberg and Anthony Mackie and The Rock, I think they all work really well together, but The Rock is by far the best of the three of them. And it is just like such a strange story. It was really refreshing and kind of strange when Pain and Gain came out, because this was at a point where I can't remember how many he'd done, but Michael Bay was full on into the Transformers films. And he still is. Like, he's got another Transformers film coming out this year. But randomly, in the middle of it all, he just drops this movie that's a lot smaller scale, a whole lot weirder, a whole lot more, like, gross out and dark. And I don't know. It was so unlike the movies he had become known for that I probably thought more highly of it than I would have if it had just come out before any of the Transformers films. It was a real pleasant surprise, and maybe that's just yet another testament to the fact that The Rock is kind of like franchise gold or movie gold. Just put him in your movie, and all is forgiven. TK, did you see Pain and Gain?
No, I can't say I have.
Interesting. So my number one, as I said before, I think this is actually one of the worst movies that The Rock has appeared in, but I think it is one of his best performances, and that is Richard Kelly's Southland Tales from 2006. Out of curiosity, have either of you guys seen Southland Tales?
Yes, I really hate this movie. I just thought it was like, it had an amazing cast, but I thought it was a crushing bore. I'm really not a Richard Kelly fan at all, aside from Donnie Darko, but, I mean, but any problems I have with this movie have nothing to do with The Rock, but, honestly, the movie just went through one ear and one, yeah, there's that I barely remember, like, his performance in it at all.
Okay, so I can't really tell you what this movie is about, because I'm not sure I even understand it. I had to look it up on Wikipedia to refresh my memory, but it's just as convoluted and confusing as my memory of it was. So, like, it's set in an alternate history where World War III has been set off, and the internet is, like, censored, and there's, like, a rip in space-time that people have walked through. Oh, man, like, I've just, like, you just lose the thread so quickly. Like, Sean William Scott plays twins who are the same person from alternate dimensions. Kevin Smith is in terrible old age makeup, is, like, the leader of a neo-Marxist revolution. It is just so weird, and as you said, Robin, like, the cast on this thing is unbelievable. Besides The Rock, Sean William Scott, Sarah Michelle Gellar, Justin Timberlake, Miranda Richardson, Wallace Shawn, Bae Ling, John Larroquette, Kevin Smith, John Lovitz, Amy Poehler, Christopher Lambert is even in this? I didn't even remember he was in this. It's crazy, the cast, but the film itself is utterly incomprehensible. All that being said, the best part of this movie is by far Dwayne Johnson as a character named Boxer Santeros, who is an action star with amnesia, and he gets his hands on a screenplay that foretells the end of the world. I can try to describe it, but it just sounds like garbledygook. What I will say, though, is that The Rock is doing something really cool here, because he is playing an action star, and this is still fairly early in his acting career, you know, 2006. It's only 5 years away from, like, The Mummy Returns. And this is him really showing off, like, his range and his comedic timing, because Boxer Santeros, this amnesiac action star, is filled with self-doubt and anxiety, and the Rock gives him all these, like, little sort of tics. Like, he does this thing where he arches his fingers and sort of taps his fingertips together when he's nervous, and it works. He's just absolutely incredible. I was trying to find some quotes from his character to sort of illustrate the amazing dialogue that he's delivering here, but sadly, you know, a lot of this is just more garbledygook. It's more gibberish from Richard Kelly, because this movie makes no sense. But The Rock, here are a couple of choice lines from The Rock's character of Boxer Santeros. "I'm a pimp, and pimps don't commit suicide." pretty good. Or, "Do you ever feel like there's 1,000 people locked inside of you? But it's your memory that keeps them glued together, keeps all these people from fighting one another. Maybe in the end, that's all we have. The memory gospel." Like, nonsense, right? Like, it's utter gibberish. But when you see The Rock saying these lines, it kind of resonates. Maybe this is, like, the ultimate
memory glue. I'm sorry. Like, I haven't seen this, but just hearing the dialogue is, like, all I can see is him saying that stuff with his arched eyebrow, and I just can't take it seriously.
Here he is describing the character from the screenplay that foretells the end of the world. "My character, he realizes that the apocalyptic crime rate is because of global deceleration. The rotation of the Earth is slowing down at a rate of 0.00006 miles per hour each day, disrupting the chemical equilibrium in the human brain, causing very irrational criminal behavior. The oceanography disaster specialist, sweetheart, is my character, and his name is Jericho Kane." Like, it's enough to make your head spin, but The Rock can make you believe it. So, like, maybe this really is the ultimate example of what we've been talking about, where it doesn't matter what he's in, The Rock will always make it better just by appearing in it. So I would challenge anybody to, former co-host of this podcast from years ago, Tom Lando, loves Southland Tales. And so on his behalf, I challenge all listeners to go and watch Southland Tales and A, try to tell me what it's about, but B, tell me if it is made better because of The Rock, because I genuinely think it is. And maybe this is another case of, like, go on YouTube and look at the highlights of The Rock, because, I mean, he's just great. He's really terrific. But Southland Tales is not a good movie. Are there any other films that you guys, or just roles that you guys want to touch on from The Rock?
I also want to mention Be Cool, which is another mediocre movie, but he totally steals it in every scene he's in, playing this, like, gay bodyguard who wants to become an actor, and he has this hilarious scene where he's trying to, like, deliver a monologue as an audition, and he uses, like, a speech from Bring It On, of all movies. It's definitely the highlight of the movie, and I think this was one of the roles where, after playing action for so long, he just decided to do a comedy, stole the movie, and everyone said, hey, this guy's got a lot of range, maybe we should give him more roles.
And his character in it also has a really hilarious, like, cowboy music video that he's in. And that whole thing is on YouTube as well, which you should watch.
Yes, that's another movie where you watch the clips of him on YouTube, but you don't have to watch the entire movie because it's mediocre overall. Also loved him in Get Smart. He played, like, a fellow special agent who turns out to be the villain and pretty much steals whatever scene he's in. And also, the movie Hercules, it's not a good movie overall, but it's pretty much worth watching for his big climactic scene where he's in change and actually, and Ian McShane is giving him a motivational speech and he literally says, I am Hercules, before breaking the chains with his bare arms and, like, attacking the bad guys. It feels like a scene out of the cheesy Italian Hercules movies from the 50s and 60s, but the Rock pretty much plays it with gusto.
That's actually my pick for the worst movie that he's been in. Again, he's not bad. And as I've been saying this whole podcast, like, I don't think that he's ever going to deliver just a bad performance, but he's been in some bad movies. And that Hercules movie I found to be a real stinker and just a waste of a lot of the talents in it. Because, like you said, it has, like, Ian McShane, it has Rufus Sewell. It's got The Rock in it. It has no excuse for being a lackluster movie. We've already talked about the movies in my honorable mentions for him, that Be Cool, Pain and Gain in particular. But I've seen, like I said, you know, I've seen sort of a disproportionate number of the movies that he's appeared in. And I even saw a number of them in theaters. So, like, here are just a few other Rock movies that I saw, but I can't say as any of them were especially good. Like, Doom is not a very good movie, but The Rock is great in it as Sarge, and he gets to deliver the line, BFG, big fucking gun. I mean, great. That's awesome, right?
That's actually my pick for the worst movie with The Rock, because even with him, it really doesn't have any redeeming characteristics at all. It's one of the very worst of the video game movies, and I think this was the one where he apparently he said he was starting to question, like, his transition to acting because it was a bomb and it did pretty poorly, and he was kind of like, he had a string there of movies that weren't too successful and kind of made him, like, rethink things, but thankfully he recovered.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what it is. Like, maybe you just got to pay your dues and do a lot of really bad movies before you can fully ascend to fame. Like, he was also in Faster, which is a pretty lame sort of car chase-y movie. And, like, Journey to the Center of the Earth 2, The Mysterious Island. What, out of curiosity, what is it with The Rock following up Brendan Fraser movies? Because, of course, Brendan Fraser was Journey to the Center of the Earth, the remake. Anyway, interesting. Maybe this is...
So is he going to do a remake of, he's going to do a remake of Encino Man next.
Oh boy, do I hope so. I mean, dude, he could totally play Cro-Magnon.
I would pay good money to see that. And but as long as it's like a perfect, like they do it shot for shot, I want the same actors there. I don't care if they've aged. As long as he plays Link, I will watch that movie 100 times.
That would be incredible.
I really like Encino Man, and it's such a stupid film to enjoy.
I mean, maybe this is the takeaway, is like, if you want to make your sequel successful, put The Rock in it. Look what happened in the Fast and Furious movies. I mean, they're making Journey to the Center of the Earth 3. It's been announced, and The Rock is starring in it, so, like, Brendan Fraser didn't successfully launch that franchise. It was The Rock that salvaged it. And he's going to be in another Jumanji movie? Like, that seems, especially after the death of Robin Williams, a sequel to Jumanji seems like a terrible idea. But you know what? The Rock could pull it off. The Rock is likable enough that he could absolutely pull that movie off. So it's, yeah, I guess maybe that's the lesson here. It's just put The Rock in your sequel. Oh, it's San Andreas is another of his films that I saw where I was like, yeah, whatever. Like, what's his character in that one? I don't know, but I kind of feel like he single-handedly made that movie successful.
Even the game plan, which I watched solely for him, and it's like, it's a kind of cheesy movie, like aimed at kids, but he is so likable and charming in it that he almost makes it worth watching. And I think it was a turning point because he kind of, it was him like just showing his comedic acting chops in mediocre movies and eventually like you said, paying his dues and moving on to better projects because of it.
What do you guys think of Baywatch? The trailers for Baywatch, I've seen a number of trailers for it. And The Rock is the big headlining star next to Zac Efron. What do you guys think of this one?
I actually kind of am looking forward to it because it looks like it's going to be done in the style of like 21 Jump Street, where it totally pokes fun of itself and becomes surprisingly entertaining. And The Rock looks like he'll be great in it. And I could see him having good chemistry with Zac Efron. So I think it could be pretty fun.
Yeah, it's again, it's kind of perfect casting. Like if you're looking for comedy and charisma, The Rock has them both, and then he also has that amazing beach body. Like, we know he looks good just walking around in his short shorts all greased up, like they do in Baywatch. So, yeah, you know, I mean, I'm probably not going to rush out to see it in theaters, but I bet this Baywatch movie will actually be pretty fun. But here's the big question, guys. This is sort of like the sink or swim question for The Rock. Can The Rock go too far? Because it's been rumored for a while now that he might play Jack Burton in a remake of Big Trouble in Little China. And I know we're all fans of Big Trouble in Little China. We all really like Kurt Russell, as we've discussed on a podcast not that long ago. Is this going too far, guys? Like, what do you think of this? Can you reconcile a remake of Big Trouble in Little China if it stars The Rock?
I think I can because I think he's the actor who will know how to nail the character, because that's kind of the thing with Jack Burton is that he's an incompetent hero. Like, nothing he really does in the movie makes much difference to solving the conflict. He's kind of the guy who screws it up. And it's like, if a regular action star took on this role, they'd want to make Jack Burton kind of maybe into a badass. But I know that The Rock will have the self-awareness to know that the best way to play the character is to kind of play him as an incompetent moron and do it with a self-deprecating style. So I think he is the one actor who could nail the character and make it work.
I mean, TK, what do you think?
See, I watched Big Trouble in Little China recently whenever we did our Kurt Russell film. And like, while I enjoyed it, it didn't, I know, I guess I must be missing the mass appeal that people seem to enjoy of it. I think I would watch a remake and probably get a little bit more out of it, I think.
With The Rock as Jack Burton?
I think I'd have a good time watching that, yeah.
All right, so Caitlin watched Big Trouble in Little China with me last year sometime. I believe it was last year. And it is not, on the surface, this does not seem like the kind of movie that my wife would particularly enjoy. However, this is how I sold it to her. This is sort of the secret of Big Trouble in Little China, the thing that I think makes it a terrific movie, which is that Jack Burton, Kurt Russell, thinks he's the main character, but he's not. He's the sidekick. And if you know that secret, the whole movie just becomes brilliant, because Jack Burton is this braggart, loudmouth idiot. He thinks he is hot shit. He thinks he is the cool guy in the room. But he is completely out of his depth, surrounded by Chinese magic and kung fu and demons and sorcerers. And he even knocks himself out for a big chunk of the main fight scene when he shoots his gun into the air and the ceiling falls on him. So Jack Burton thinks he's the hero, but he is the sidekick, and that's the joke. If The Rock more than The Rock, it's like if the people remaking it understand that, and The Rock understands that fact, it could be great. Because we've seen The Rock play an insecure character. Like, if he takes, like, all the weird insecurities from something like Southland Tales or Pain and Gain and applies them to a character like Jack Burton, it could actually be really funny. Especially because The Rock is huge and imposing. Like, he's enormous compared to Kurt Russell. But if he's still just as much of a bumbling braggart jerk who does everything wrong, it could be even funnier in a lot of ways. So I'd be willing to give The Rock the benefit of the doubt, even though I'm sort of firmly against remaking Big Trouble in Little China. I don't think it's a movie that you should bother remaking, but I mean, if you gotta do it, why not do it with The Rock, right? Any final thoughts on Dwayne Johnson before we draw our conversation of his career to a close?
Well, you talked about how he's got something like 12 movies like in the pipelines project. He just has the most insane work ethic ever, because there was a couple of years ago where he actually made a brief comeback to wrestling to wrestle a few WrestleMania matches with John Cena. And it's just incredible that he alternated between wrestling these matches and making movies. And it got to the point where he got like injured in his last match with John Cena, and it could have jeopardized the production of Hercules because they started shooting it immediately afterwards, but thankfully he was fine. So he's probably not going to wrestle any matches anymore, but he still makes like the odd cameo appearance at WrestleMania and stuff. And I just look at his schedule and just find it astounding that he was able to like do both and stuff. But I think that's why he's become such a big star, is because he just has the most insane work ethic out of anybody, yet he still remains a nice, charming, likable guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny. Looking ahead in his filmography, you see films like, you know, Jumanji 2, Journey to the Center of the Earth 3, San Andreas 2. He's in a movie, Rampage, based on that old Nintendo game where it's like a fighting game with King Kong and Godzilla. He's going to be the star of that movie.
I'll watch this one too.
Yeah. None of these movies are movies that I would be interested in on the premise alone. But his involvement instantly makes me curious to see, like, okay, what's he up to this time? Jumanji starring The Rock? What the heck does that look like? I'm always intrigued, even if the movies themselves don't sound like my cup of tea. So, once again, I guess that is what The Rock is cooking. We've finally answered the question. It's that. The Rock is cooking up some success, and we can all smell it from here. And with that, it's time to play The Ticket Price is Right, the box office prediction game where we try to predict the opening weekend box office grosses of movies being released this week, and we also look back on last week's predictions. It's actually a couple weeks back. We've been on hiatus briefly. And the last time, we were predicting the opening totals for two movies, The Smurfs, The Lost Village, and going in style, an old guy's heist movie directed by Zach Braff. And guess what? TK won them both. He was right. Well, he wasn't.
Are you kidding me?
you got it both. So The Smurfs did far worse than Robin and I predicted. You said it would make $10 million, TK. It made $13 million. The next highest bid was mine, which was $18 million. So you got that one. And then going in style, it made $12 million. You said it would make $15 million. So that's another 2 points, which means that TK is now at 10 points and Robin and I are each at 5. So TK, you've got double our score, man.
I'm literally speechless. I don't know how this keeps happening, but I hope it doesn't stop.
It's TK's year. So this time, we're again predicting the opening totals for two movies. First up is the like social media thriller The Circle, starring Emma Watson and Tom Hanks and Bill Paxton in his last role. The Circle has a budget of $18 million. It's based on a novel, which tells me TK might know a thing or two about it, but I get first pick, and I don't think it's going to do well. I really haven't heard anything, any good buzz about it. So I think it's going to make $10 million, and most of that is just going to be because Emma Watson's in it. TK, The Circle. How much is it going to make?
So I just finished reading this book a couple weeks ago. David Eggers is a really, really popular fiction author. So I think this is, and the book is excellent. It's probably the best thing he's written in 15 years. So I think this is going to get a lot more push than people think it's going to be. So I'm going to say it's going to be do about 20.
20 million. And Robin, how much do you think The Circle is going to make?
I'll go in between. It also has Tom Hanks in it, so it does have more star power, but it's gotten pretty bad reviews, so I'm going to go with $15
million. $15 million. And then up next is How to Be a Latin Lover. It's got a good cast for a comedy, but this is another one that I just haven't heard a lot of buzz about, and I couldn't even find its budget. I'm guessing that How to Be a Latin Lover actually has a pretty low budget, though. So just between a low budget and a lack of buzz, I'm going to say it'll make $5 million. I don't think this is going to do well. TK, what do you think?
I'm going to go with 7.5.
7.5, a little higher than me. And Robin.
I'll go a little lower. I'll go with 3 because I haven't heard a thing about it, and I don't think it's been screened for critics because it doesn't have a Rotten Tomatoes rating, so I think it's going to bomb.
Not a good sign. And now it is time for the dumb joke of the week. I was going to marry my English teacher when she got out of prison, but apparently you can't end a sentence with a proposition. I mean, that's a good joke. That's a really good joke, I think. Come on, guys. A good one. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so at The Back Row. You can contact TK at tk@the-back-row.com, but he really doesn't associate with me outside of this podcast because he doesn't like hearing my jokes. See, he's not even going to respond. He's just like, no.
He's already walked out.
Yeah, he's gone.
I unplug my headset, actually, as soon as we finish the ticket prices right now.
Robin can be reached by emailing robin.warder@the-back-row.com, and be sure to listen to The Trail Went Cold, Robin's true crime podcast that I produce and edit. It releases a new episode every Wednesday, and it's gaining quite a following. You too can find out about the Terry McClure case and see an amazing mullet in the photo that is the icon for that episode. And of course, you can also read Robin's writing at cracked.com. He's got a new article. What is that article again, Robin?
It's about celebrity hypocrisy. It has a story in there how in 1988, George Lucas appeared in front of Congress and said that the alteration of films is barbaric. Pot calling kettle black.
And of course, all of Robin's work on listverse.com as well. He's got a lot of articles there. And the-back-row.com, where you can read Robin's underrated gems and listen to this podcast. This guy is just all over the internet. And as for me, well, you can reach me by emailing gil@the-back-row.com, and you can find all of the stuff I'm involved with at The Back Row. McGillfoot.com, which is linked to on our front page, is my video editing portfolio, and of course, The Trail Went Cold at trailwentcold.com. All of it is found through the-back-row.com. Thank you so much for listening, and let's layeth the smacketh down, guys. Shouts from The Back Row is part of the Back Row Podcast Network. Visit the-back-row.com for more. The Shouts from The Back Row theme is composed by Vince Nightrow.